Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to focus on a very important area. We're going to talk about cardiovascular prevention with, I think, one of the preeminent experts in this field. He's been a guest in the past on my radio program, and now he's here to join us on the podcast. He's Dr. Mark Houston. He is head of something called the Hypertension Institute, which is located in Nashville. And he is also someone who's been very involved in developing programs of nutritional supplements to overcome cardiovascular disease and prevent and treat hypertension. He's not just an expert in nutrition. He's also written conventional textbooks on hypertension, but among his popular books that you might know him by, What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Hypertension. Also, What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Heart Disease. And he is also currently involved academically as the Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He's the Medical Director of the Division of Human Nutrition at St. Thomas Hospital in Nashville, Tennessee. It's good that they have a Division of Human Nutrition down there in Nashville, Tennessee, at the local hospital. He's triple board certified, which means he's got the internal medicine boards. He's also got board certification by the American Society of Hypertension, and he has a complementary medicine board certification in anti-aging and regenerative medicine. And he's got credentials galore. He's published over 200 medical articles, and we'd have to exhaust the entire time in our podcast reciting his credentials. So without further ado, here's Dr. Mark Houston. Mark, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Pleasure to be with you again. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Okay, so, you know, over your long career, I mean, you started working in with medications, and you're really an expert in helping teach doctors how to prescribe medications for hypertension. But at a certain point in your career, you recognized that that alone wasn't going to help us win the war against high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease, I guess.
Exactly. In the mid-90s, Ronald, when I started looking really at more at nutrition and nutritional supplements as well as other lifestyle changes to try to prevent people from even getting hypertension, and then also those who had it, attempt to taper them off some of their antihypertensive medications and see if we could limit some of the adverse effects and improve compliance with the lifestyle.
Have we gotten better in our treatment of hypertension? You know, in the past 10 or 20 years, there's been a proliferation of new medications for high blood pressure. Have we been turning the corner on this problem, or have some people slipped through in spite of that?
Well, we've certainly got better medications. They do have less side effects, but the statistics on the number of people who actually are compliant and take the medications has not really gotten a lot better. You know, half the people don't even know they have hypertension, and the half that know they have it don't even take their medicine. So, and there are a lot of reasons, cost, side effects, and other things that people prefer nutrition and natural treatments as opposed to drugs.
Yeah, I actually did a little research on a phenomenon called prehypertension, which is important, and you can talk to us about it. But in the studies of prehypertension, you know, while it's clear that you sometimes need medication to treat frank hypertension, I think you'd agree. I mean, you're not so committed to holistic medicine that you say nobody needs medication. There's some people who definitely need medication along with diet, lifestyle, and supplements. But in prehypertension, which is borderline blood pressure, there's now a lot of controversies. A, should you treat it with medication? There's actually conflicting guidelines now about it. And then the question is, do people benefit more from the drugs or from lifestyle modification? I think it's probably the latter.
Yeah, there's the new JNC8 that just came out has sort of thrown some different ideas about blood pressure levels for older people, but also changed even some of the recommendations for younger patients. I think the idea that people need to understand is blood pressure risk related to cardiovascular disease is a continuum, meaning that there's a point at which the blood pressure is pretty much not a risk, and that's usually around 110 over 70. And as you start moving up from that level, there's increasing risk, and then it really starts to take off to be a significant risk at about 140 over 90. Now, the group you're talking about, the pre-hypersensitive, is defined as about 121 on the top number up to about 130, maybe up to 139, depending on which articles you look at. And then the diastolic is typically somewhere between 81 and 90. So in that range, people say, you know, do you need drugs? Can you get by with nutritional supplements and nutrition? And what is the best way to do it? And there's a lot of disagreement about what's the most effective way. What I typically do is they don't have target organ damage, meaning they don't have heart failure or kidney problems, is I really give them an intense non-drug program initially to try to get them under control if they're in that borderline pre-hypertensive range.
And what does that program consist of? Because it's my impression that it's different strokes for different folks. I mean, in some cases, hypertension is precisely that, stress, too much tension. For others, it may be related to obesity, although sometimes we'll see a skinny toothpick of a person coming in with high blood pressure. So do you have a way of differentiating subtypes of hypertension that may lend themselves to different approaches?
Yeah, we do, and you're right. There's a lot of different ways to approach a patient depending on how you define what's causing their hypertension. And ours is a very comprehensive approach. We look at stratification, that is, what's driving the blood pressure, both lifestyle but also looking at biochemical parameters. So we look at their sleeping patterns, their stress patterns, their nutritional status, you know, how much sodium do they take in. Are they eating a lot of fast foods and not eating a lot of fruits and vegetables? And then we look at the biochemical markers. It's a little sophisticated, but it's called plasma renin activity. And it basically tells you what kind of hypertension you have that's driving it, and that's treated in different ways depending on what you find out.
Because certain drugs target one type versus others.
Exactly. So there's two major groups, the high renin and the low renin. So if you define that, you can select the right drug class without having to guess, and it avoids a lot of manipulation with drugs over a period of time. You get to the answer a lot quicker and get them controlled. And then we add in that the lifestyle changes, and by doing so, and we've actually published data on this now, showing that if you're in the mild hypertension section, we can get about 62% of people off medication using our aggressive lifestyle program within 12 months.
Wow, that's fantastic. Because, you know, I think it's actually the norm now that the average person over you might know the statistic, the average person over the age of 55 or 60, they're more likely than not to be hypertensive and on medication and perhaps off medication improperly.
Yeah, in this country, there's an increasing hypertension as you get older, and it's particularly the systolic blood pressure that goes up with age in the U.S.
Is that thought to be a natural consequence of aging, or is it related to modifiable lifestyle factors?
It's really, I think, modifiable life factors, because if you look at Paleolithic societies, like in South America, who don't have our type of diet, who exercise, stay slim, they don't develop systolic hypertension with age. In fact, mm-hmm. Their blood pressure stay pretty much the same throughout life, 110, 120, over 70 to 80, but not here in the U.S.
Right. I mean, we tend to think of this as, you know, like a natural consequence of aging, like hardening of the arteries is just like wrinkles, that's just the way it goes. But if, you know, as you cite the examples of societies where older adults are very active, they eat a very balanced diet that's low in junk, they don't go that direction.
No. I mean, everybody gets stiffer arteries as you get older, but the degree by which you get there is definitely can be modified with a proper diet and exercise program.
You mentioned the effects of sodium, and how big a role do you think that plays, and is it a universal phenomenon? Should everyone be on an ultra-low-salt diet, as is sometimes recommended, the so-called DASH diet?
My personal opinion is sodium chloride, which is table salt, is a very bad actor for not just hypertension, but cardiovascular disease, stroke, MI, heart failure, and even renal disease above certain levels. So I try to keep people down to a fairly low range of 1.5 to 2 grams of sodium chloride per day, and then try to get their potassium and their magnesium up to much higher level. So we've got.
So you're also talking about balance there. You're talking about ratios, not necessarily absolute amounts. So if you can tweak the magnesium and potassium to a higher level, then that might offset some of the adverse effects of moderate sodium.
Exactly. Potassium, particularly magnesium, also can counterbalance most of the adverse effects that sodium causes on the cardiovascular system.
So clearly we have taken a wrong turn in our society by eating refined foods that are depleted of potassium and magnesium, not enough vegetables and fruits, and substituting processed food that's rich in sodium.
Typically, the American diet is about 2-to-1 sodium to potassium, and it actually should be something like 5-to-1 potassium to sodium. Mm. So that's what I try to do in the diet, but also if I have to use, you know, a potassium substitute that's natural, not a prescription drug, because there's a lot of ways to do that. Flip that ratio around, people's blood pressure and the risk for CVD, cardiovascular disease, does go down.
What about the issue of insulin resistance? How big a role does that play in driving blood pressure up?
That's a huge part of hypertension. About 70% of people who have hypertension have insulin resistance. And the way the insulin does that is it changes the way the kidney handles salt and water, along with other things. So you get endothelial dysfunction, the arteries are more constricted, and then you basically fill up the tank by increasing sodium chloride reabsorption in the kidney, so your arteries are constricted, the volume's up, and the pressure tends to go up as a consequence of those two things.
So it's not just a matter of abnormal blood sugar. There are consequences to blood pressure from insulin resistance as well.
Yeah, the insulin itself is a perpetuating factor for hypertension and heart attack, and then you add the hyperglycemia on top of it, it is just another dimension of vascular disease.
Wow. And then of course, there's the stress component. How often do you see a patient where hypertension is just a matter of pure stress reaction?
It's very common, I think, now in virtually any medical practice. Everybody come in has got huge amounts of stress. And when I see people either change jobs, quit, retire, whatever, a lot of times they come back in 3 or 4 months and their blood pressure's either normal or low, and I have to start reducing their medication. So there's no question stress is a major factor in hypertension.
And clearly genetic factors, because we know that certain subpopulations, African Americans, for example, have a higher rate of hypertension. Some people cite economic disadvantage or racism as being a factor, but also clearly their genetic predispositions. And it even appears that different medications work differently in different races.
Absolutely. If you look at the African American population, they tend to have a different type of renin hypertension. It's usually called low renin, more dependent on the volume. They tend to respond better to diuretics and calcium blockers. The African-American population has a unique finding related to the nocturnal blood pressure. The pressure doesn't drop at night as it should in a lot of these patients. They don't have what's called a proper dipping status. And we found studies recently that really will say that nocturnal blood pressure is really the driving force and the most important issue related to cardiovascular risk. So if you don't dip at night, risk for stroke and heart attack actually is higher.
You've got to be a dipper.
Yeah, you've got to be a dipper. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
That's a state of a vascular relaxation that you achieve in deep sleep, but it doesn't occur for some people.
Right.
One of the more interesting cases that I've had recently is a hypertensive who is a very active guy who was on an excellent diet and was muscular and thin and took a whole raft of supplements but had very high blood pressure. And after about the second or third visit, it occurred to me to ask, and his wife was there, do you snore? And he kind of shrugged his shoulders, and the wife just rolled her eyes and said, does he snore? He says, the whole house shakes. And we discovered that he had, this is a familiar scenario for you because you look at this on a routine basis. He had sleep apnea. And tell us about the role that might play in hypertension.
Yeah, if you look at secondary cause of hypertension in the United States, sleep apnea is the number one cause.
Hmm. often
first
missed.
Thing I look at.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always ask the spouse or the significant other to give me the history because the patient really never knows. And you'll find it's very common as the most secondary cause for hypertension. And after that, you run into less common causes related to problems of the kidney or some other thing. But always look for obstructive sleep apnea.
And I guess the reason being that it the sleep deprivation or the stress of near asphyxiation sets off alarms in the body that send the blood pressure up.
Yeah, they have documented, as you know, hypoxemia, low oxygen, high carbon dioxide. They get endothelial dysfunction, vasoconstriction, and because they have chronically interrupted sleep patterns, even though they may be a dipper if they slept good, you know, appropriate blood pressure reduction at night, so they're running the non-dipping pattern.
Yeah, so another factor that's being looked at is it appears that people who are located near a lot of automobile pollution, or even it's been found on days where there's air pollution alerts, that there's a higher risk of heart attack, that literally the toxins that you breathe in may affect your arterial walls.
Exactly. Any type of pesticide, organicide, air pollution, water pollution, whatever, has been shown to clearly increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, particularly myocardial infarction.
Yeah, so that's another important perspective on this problem. You mentioned earlier that they're taking a critical look at blood pressure goals. You know, we tend to think, well, it's very, very important to get blood pressure down, and doctors being zealous and conscientious, and they like to follow guidelines and protocols, that sometimes they may be performing a disservice to older patients by over-treating high blood pressure. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the recent JNCA recommendations that just came out have reset the standards for older patients to 150 over 90. And the reason for that is...
Wait, 150 over 90? Wow, that sounds very high.
Yeah, they really shot it up higher than we've ever had before. And part of it's based on the fact they can't find any clinical trials that have shown that in an older patient, and we're defining, you know, older patients as over 65 here, that if you reduce blood pressure below 150 over 90 with a drug, that you actually show improvement in stroke and heart attack, heart failure, and kidney disease. Now, that's not to say that getting it lower might not be of help, but it's hard to prove that based on evidence-based medicine. Now, the reason for that on the downside is in older people, because the arteries are very stiff, if you drop the pressure too low, they can't accommodate with the normal elasticity in the arteries to try to maintain an adequate heart rate and blood pressure, so you can reduce what's called perfusion pressure. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you decrease blood supply and oxygen to the brain, the heart, kidneys, and you can actually increase the risk of ischemic disease in the brain and the heart by getting the pressure too low.
Wow. So, you know, not enough blood gets to that critical organ. And goodness knows we have enough people fainting, falling, suffering from brownouts, blackouts, dementia, and sometimes the medication may be the culprit.
Yeah, and, you know, when you start breaking hips and have subdural hematomas and head injuries, then that can be detrimental to your health.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we may be protecting the heart, but putting the patient in peril. So when it comes to the world of nutritional supplements, you're actually in the process of developing a very exciting line of nutritional products for a great company, Thorne Research. They do a really good job of providing. It's not so much stuff that's available in discount drugstores and health food stores. This is actually a physician line. It's called TrueCardia. Tell us about some of the nutrients that you'll be providing in that line.
Yeah, what we've done is we're trying to go way above any other company that's out there with some new ideas and new approaches to the treatment of both hypertension, dyslipidemia, and cardiovascular disease. So what we did is I researched and have been doing this for a long time, all the clinical trials that are published in humans on what nutritional supplements are effective in either lowering blood pressure or improving the cholesterol and lipid profile. And then we took the dose and the nutrient, and we combined them into a formulation with the best science. Now, then we took that formulation and put it into a computer analysis. It's called metabolomic profiling. And in essence, what that does is it looks at the sort of the spokes of the wheel with all the interactions that go out from the hub, all the chemical, biochemical pathways throughout the body that can affect blood pressure. And the computer analyzes this nutrient, analyzes the amount of nutrient related to the other nutrients, and it kicks out the answer, say, well, what you put in was appropriate, or no, it wasn't, and this is what we should do to maybe tweak that and make it even better. So it's the optimal dose at the optimal interaction with the other nutrients.
So this is sometimes referred to in pharmacological research as fast throughput research. In other words, you kind of can process a lot of information with computer technology and do predictive models to see if you're barking up the right tree rather than a haphazard trial and error.
Exactly. And this is the first time this has ever been done in any form related to nutritional supplementation. So this will be unique. And then we're going to take the final formulation and we will do a double-blind placebo-controlled trial in humans out of the Hypertension Institute to document how much it works and what kind of reductions we can get in blood pressure and lipid levels. And then that'll get published in a peer-reviewed literature.
Wow. Okay, so you're actually going to do the research. So what are some of the nutrients that you think can make a difference?
Well, for example, the dyslipidemia product, we're using a combination of about 8 or 10 things, but some of the ones that people would really recognize that are incredibly effective are red-yeast rice, berberine, and phytosterols. We have a few other things in there, but those in combination, along with some low-dose niacin, we can, with this formulation, we think, get up to a 50% decrease in LDL cholesterol and LDL particle number, and at the same time increase the HDL functionality and the HDL particle number, which is the things you really want to look at in advanced lipid testing.
Wow. So what are some of the nutrients that might be employed in doing that?
So we got red-yeast rice, high-quality berberine, which actually makes red-yeast rice work even better because it blocks a particular biochemical in the liver that changes the way the LDL receptor works. And then the
berberine has been known to also impact insulin resistance. I guess it works in several different ways,
it's
right?
It's great for the insulin resistance and dysglycemia, as well as many other things. And so part of the effect of lipids, as well as blood pressure, is the effects on insulin with the berberine.
Right. So those are some key nutrients. Now, what is your take on niacin for lowering cholesterol? I've been wanting to ask a true expert like you about that because niacin has been a little bit in the crosshairs lately. Do you still think it may play a role in lowering cholesterol and preventing heart disease?
Absolutely. And I think, Ronald, that what happened in 2013 is we had a lot of reports that came out that said niacin didn't work. We had the AIM-HI trial, and we had one that was published by Merck Pharmaceuticals with a non-flush niacin, and all these.
They actually had to tank their own project. They withdrew that from the marketplace.
Yes, yeah. It was 20,000 patients. I mean, it spent a lot of money trying to prove that this combination drug that made your niacin.
Yeah, it was going to be a blockbuster, and they lost a lot of money.
Yeah, so interestingly, you should ask the question because I was just asked by Scripps Clinic to present what we would call questionable studies in peer-reviewed evidence-based medicine literature in the last 3 years. And one of them I'm talking about is niacin, and that's actually the end of this month in San Diego at Scripps Clinic Nutritional Conference. And I will tell you, in reviewing the literature very carefully in an objective fashion, my conclusion is that niacin does work. It still should be used. It does not have any of the adverse potential that was reported in the clinical studies, and it also is extremely effective because the studies that were done were flawed in almost every way you can think of, either methodology, statistically, patient population. I could go on and on. But I'll be presenting all the trials, and I'll dissect them for the physicians that are there and show them why niacin is still appropriate for hypertension, for CVD and dyslipidemia.
Right, and it certainly is very effective in lowering cholesterol. The only issue was that while it lowered cholesterol, people were concerned that that might not translate to real cardiovascular benefit because, you know, there are medications that, for example, lower blood sugar, but they don't reduce the risk of dying. And so it was thought that niacin was a little bit like that, and you think there still is benefit.
Yeah, because when they looked at the studies that said niacin didn't do what it was supposed to, I'll give you one example. The combination that Merck had a drug in it called Lioriprant, and it was the non-flesh component. Turns out that drug, in and of itself, has been shown to increase cardiovascular risk.
Ooh.
So can't say that the niacin was the problem. It was the drug that they used with the niacin
So it canceled out the benefits of the niacin.
Yeah exactly. And Ooh. they really didn't understand that until they started looking at the data and realized, oh my goodness, we're getting some adverse effects related to this, not the niacin.
Well, for those of our listeners who continue to use niacin, any tips for avoiding the bothersome niacin flushing?
Absolutely. What I do is I start at a low dose and I titrate up carefully over several weeks, always with food. And the real key to stopping the flushing is having to take it with quercetin. And you can do 500 milligrams of quercetin daily with your niacin. And you can throw in some apples or applesauce if you want to add a little more quercetin to your diet. And that blocks that mast cell release, which is what is the reason for the flushing.
So you would say you're taking 500 milligrams of niacin three times daily. You would take 500 milligrams of quercetin with each 500 milligram niacin, and that might neutralize the adverse effects?
Or you could take even a lower dose. Sometimes people can get by with just 500 milligrams of quercetin once a day.
Once a day, okay.
Depending on the dose, but you can always titrate up if you need to. And never drink any alcohol when you take your niacin, because that will enhance the flushing.
Right. That's a wonderful clinical pearl. You still have to watch out, however, for liver effects, because niacin can do that, get your liver function monitored by a doctor.
Yeah, always check not just for liver function, but also you want to check blood sugar and homocysteine levels, because niacin will demethylate you, and your homocysteine can go up, particularly if you have one of the genetic tendencies to hyperhomocysteinemia.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really useful clinical pearl for our listeners. So coming back to the TrueCardia product line, you know, as you say, you favor red yeast rice, not just because it lowers cholesterol, but it also has other effects, right?
Yeah, red yeast rice is really way beyond what people think it is. It's not just statin-like. It doesn't have the statin adverse effects, but it has other numerous effects on the cholesterol profiling. It's got some phytosterols in it. It has membrane stabilizing activity. So it's sort of the perfect natural anti-lipid agent out there.
And other things that you're a big believer in, by the way, I'd like to say great minds think alike, but your expertise in this field way outstrips mine. But I'm a big fan of olive leaf extract for cardiovascular prevention. I see you've included it in the product Cardiopressin.
Absolutely. As you point out, all olive products, monounsaturated fats, extra virgin olive oil, oleic acid, olive yeast extract, have been shown to not only lower blood pressure, but also they decrease the oxidation of LDL cholesterol very effectively. So it's a great product for both lipids and blood pressure.
Right, and I see in a blood pressure product, of course, coenzyme Q10. That plays a role in relaxing the endothelial tone.
Yeah, CoQ10 is one of those miraculous nutrients for just about anything that ails you. It works in heart failure, hypertension, dyslipidemia, insulin resistance. And the formulation in this one is the very best CoQ10 absorbability out there.
And something that we tend to think of as mostly for the prostate, lycopene, is something that you include in in the blood pressure product, the Cardiopressin. How does that work for the heart?
Lycopene is a very interesting compound. It works not just in blood pressure, but also in lipids. And we use a it's like a the natural lycopene that you get in a tomato extract. And the studies that were done, actually published in the American Society of Hypertension, showed that lycopene at somewhere between 10 to 20 milligrams per day as an equivalent extract lowered blood pressure about 8 to 10 over 4 to 5 millimeters of mercury. And the mechanism is multiple, but one of the main reasons it improves endothelial function and nitric oxide levels, it relaxes the artery.
Wow, good stuff. I noticed when you talk, we're talking nitric oxide, a lot of people favor the use of arginine for lowering blood pressure, promoting circulation. I don't see that as an ingredient in some of your lead products here. Is that something you still favor?
We like arginine, but if you go and look at the literature critically, arginine has to be in incredibly high doses to really have an effect.
Like 6 grams or something?
Yeah, 6 to 10 grams a
day.
And that becomes almost too much, and then you run the risk of imbalancing your amino acids. But here's the key. After the age of 40, arginine becomes less of a factor in production of nitric oxide through the ENOS enzyme than another pathway, which is basically the conversion of nitrates to nitrites through your vegetables, particularly through your oral flora and your gastric acid. So what we're doing is trying to get people off mouthwash and eating a high vegetable diet and then using other things that raise the nitric oxide through that pathway as opposed to using the arginine. Because most people that have hypertension, honestly, they're over 40.
Well, you still believe in beet juice? I mean, that's been touted as something to lower blood pressure as well.
That's exactly right. So beet juice extract, any dark green leafy vegetable, those are very effective in that other pathway of the nitrate issue.
And, of course, we can't have this discussion without talking about aged garlic extract, which might be beneficial as well for the heart and for blood pressure.
Yeah. Aged garlic has great studies at UCLA related to endothelial function, blood pressure, and lipids. So we really have jumped all over the aged garlic story for ED.
So you think that garlic may be really the key to restoring endothelial dysfunction restoring endothelial function,
Right. Yeah, the data publications on aged garlic, and it's made by a Japanese company. It's called Kaolic Garlic.
Right, the Wakanaga company.
It's a cardiovascular formula. It's like 600 milligrams twice a day. And all the studies.
Incidentally, you can mention them because they're actually a sponsor of my program. Yeah, it's okay.
So, I mean, the data is incredible. There's improvement in blood pressure, lipids, and improvement in endothelial dysfunction.
Great. So this line, a lot of people can say, wow, TrueCardia products, they sound very innovative, cutting edge. I'm going to run down to the health food store and buy me some. That's not how it works, right?
No, this is a physician line, and I like it because your physician has to assess your medical history and your needs and your lab, decide what's appropriate. Is nutrition appropriate, supplements appropriate, drugs appropriate, or a combination? And then he decides, what you need, how much you need, and then he monitors it, as opposed to someone who just goes out willy-nilly and buys some supplement that's uncontrolled and takes a dose and they don't get followed. We want people to get the best care possible. So the only way you're going to get the Thorne products is if you go to a physician and you get the proper medical care and you order it with their assistance and their follow-up.
And is this an either-or proposition where, either you're going to take these natural things, if it doesn't work, forget about that, ditch your supplements, just take medications, or are they compatible with medications?
They're very compatible with medication, and that's what I really like is we designed all these products to be either standalone or you can use them with drugs and make a very good integrated cardiovascular program.
So a couple of ways that people can access this information, they can go to your website. Where can they get more information about this?
The website is hypertensioninstitute.com.
And that's actually a good place to go down to. You have patients not just from the Nashville, Tennessee area, but you probably have patients from all over the country and all over the world who come with challenging hypertension problems, or perhaps they're just looking to reduce their burden of medications.
Yeah, we actually have pretty much an international flavor to the Institute. And we make it very easy for people to come in for a consultation, and usually takes us 2, at most 3 days to get all the testing done, the consultation, and a treatment program in place for them.
And you put them up at the Drake Hotel where they have the ducks walking around the lobby?
Well, we're at the other end of the state.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
The Drake's in Memphis.
I'm thinking
we're in Nashville. But we
always get
at an equivalently good hotel, yes.
I always get that confused. I'm sorry.
Right, yeah.
So,
that's Elvis country.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and the other way that people can access this is via your product line, which it's actually not your product. It's something that you've consulted on for the Thorn group. There's information about the TrueCardia products on the web. They're actually just being rolled out, so the information is about the first couple of products, and there are a couple more that are in the process of being developed. MitoBio and ArterioCare, correct?
Yeah, we'll have the lipid product out first, followed by the blood pressure, and then the other two you mentioned, the MitoBio is to improve mitochondrial dysfunction, and the last one, ArterioCare, is specifically for coronary heart disease and try to reduce plaque progression and actually increase regression in the arteries in the heart.
I imagine that Thorn maintains a roster of physicians who carry and utilize those products.
Yes, they do.
Okay, so that would, you know, so if you're desirous of obtaining that type of product under the care and guidance of an experienced complementary physician, then contact the folks at Thorn, or go to, I guess it's TrueCardia.com is the place where you can get information. So, fantastic. Anything you want to add to this, or talk a little bit about the effects of exercise? So certainly that's an important part of the equation.
Absolutely. And we have a very aggressive exercise program. I have a full-time nutritionist and an exercise physiologists that both have masters in nutrition and exercise. So we use the whole program. And, you know, Hippocrates figured it a long time ago when he said exercise will cure most of the ill humors that man puts upon himself. So we really try to get people to do a combined aerobic and resistance training program.
Well, great. I mean, certainly you're doing a lot of good, and you're bringing a high level of expertise to a complicated field. And, you know, I have to say that for the most part, management of hypertension in this country is a mess. It's a mishmash of drugs. Many physicians are highly skilled, but many physicians kind of play by the, you know, they do sort of paint-by-numbers medicine, using, you know, whatever they see in the most recent lurid drug ad to treat patients. And it's a hit-or-miss process, and I think you've really elevated it into a science.
Well, I appreciate that. We try to shed some light on a complicated topic.
Indeed, it really is an art to manage high blood pressure, sometimes with a combination of medications and lifestyle modifications, and now with the right kind of nutritional supplements. Thanks very much, Dr. Mark Houston, for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you at or hearing you speak at a medical meeting soon. I think you're probably coming to New York soon this
yes,
February.
Yes, I'll be at the big conference.
Why don't we plug that? We have health practitioners who listen to this podcast. You're going to be at something called the Integrative Health Symposium. You probably don't even know your schedule. You're just going to somebody's
coming up in February. I think it's at the Hilton.
Right.
There in New York, and it's one of the largest integrative conferences in the world, so it's quite good.
Well, I look forward to seeing you. I'll be in the audience. I'll come up and shake your hand. And I recommend it very highly for health practitioners in the New York, New Jersey, tri-state area. Get down to the Integrative Health Symposium and at the very least hear the great lecture that Mark Houston is about to give there.
Great. Thanks so much, Ron. It's been a pleasure chatting with you again.
My pleasure. All the best to you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.